Initially, director Jen Abbott was opposed to the idea of making a sequel to 2003's eye-opening award-winning film, The Corporation. But eventually she realised it was, unfortunately, a necessary sequel. The sequel picks up where The Corporation left off 7 years ago, charting the rise of corporate power to an all-time high. But now corporations insist they are more caring and conscientious. They want to save the planet, and profits aren't the end all. But do they really care? I began the interview with Jen Abbott by asking why the unfortunately necessary was necessary.
Well, unfortunately, we felt it was necessary because so many of the issues that we explored in our 2003 documentary related to corporate rule and really bad practices, which are resulting in just so much injustice and destruction around the world, were really just getting exponentially worse. And even though I personally actually did not want to undertake a sequel, you know, I was really proud of the first film, and it was just a monster of a film to wrestle to the ground, a little bit reluctant to do it again. There came a time, especially when Trump was elected, that we just felt, okay, it's time to make a sequel.
Why were you so reluctant?
You know, I'm proud of the first film. I think sequels, there's a lot of pressure on sequels to live up to the first film, which I am proud to say I think we did with our sequel. But also, you know, until Trump was elected, for me personally, and this is not the case for my co-director, Joel Bakken, for me personally, I didn't have a lot of additional analysis to contribute. But when Trump was elected, what happened for me was the veil came down. There was no longer the pretense that corporations and government were acting independently. There they were rigging the system in plain view. And so it was really for me at that moment that I thought, okay, we've just got to dive in again.
I find that interesting because there are events like the GFC 2008, the BP oil disaster, or disasters, I should say, which in and of themselves are worthy of a feature-length documentary like this, and yet it took the election of Trump for you to really be motivated to do this film.
Well, I think absolutely. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm not suggesting that there weren't significant corporate harms throughout the world happening in this entire trajectory. Absolutely, there were. It was really because our film, you know, we analyze these issues in depth. We provide a theoretical overlay. We don't just tell the story of BP oil spill, for example. We sort of try and dig deeper and analyze its root causes. So when I say that I didn't feel like I had a whole lot additionally to say about this topic, because I actually, at the time I started the sequel, I was in production with another film that is also at Doc Edge, The Magnitude of All Things. And analytically, theoretically, for me, things hadn't changed so much that it warranted a sequel. To be honest, it could also have been I co-directed the first film. I also edited it from 400 hours of footage. And as I say, it was just a monster of a film to wrestle to the ground. And the idea of going back and doing something like it again was, it really took a lot out of me, the first film. So perhaps my reluctance was also based on that. Not that I shy away from big projects, just perhaps I hadn't recovered fully from making the first film so many years ago.
No, I understand. Was this just as monstrous, or was it bigger? Because you cover a lot of the globe and speak to an amazing array of interviewees in the documentary. It seems to me this one might have been even bigger to undertake.
Yeah, you know, I think that's one of the inherent features of making a film about the corporation, that really the question is, what do you not include? Simply because of its hegemony, because it just infiltrates every tiny crack down to the minutiae of our human cells to outer space to, you know, it just goes on and on and on. So as you point out, it really is a mammoth subject matter. And so with regards to whether this was even larger in scope, I would say so, because for the first film, we really focused on the institution of the corporation, wherein with the second film, we felt the zeitgeist was such and that our audiences would now be open to not only looking at the institution, but also let's look at the system, 21st century extractive capitalism. And though we don't name it, let's also look at the ideology many call neoliberalism, which you know, is really the value system and value set that supports capitalism and the corporation.
There are many big corporations who honestly and fervently believe that they are doing quote unquote good for society. What's your response to those corporations who will potentially view this documentary as a belittling of them and their work, which they say is for the betterment of society itself?
Sure. Well, I don't think that anyone is saying that some corporations aren't doing some good. I mean, without question, they provide many goods and services that we all need and rely on and have come to actually perhaps even be addicted to. So, you know, I don't think that people should misunderstand our film. What we're really talking about is right relationship. So, yes, corporations, markets, capitalism have a purpose. I mean, I myself really think that we have to start considering other forms of organizing our economies other than capitalism, but markets and corporations absolutely have a purpose and play a role in our society in some instances that are valuable. But really the question is, what is their place in society? They should not be governing bodies. They should not have outsized power. And that is really the problem. And so our foundational narrative tension in our film is between corporations and democracy. So we're really saying we need to reinvigorate democracy so that the corporations serve the public good and also are acting in accordance to creating a livable future. So, you know, really for us, it's about right relationship and the reinvigoration of democracy in all its forms.
So you believe, and I think this comes through the film too, that there are corporations that do have corporate responsibility, despite what Robert Reich says in the film itself, which is that there is no such thing as corporate responsibility. It's an interesting kind of dichotomy to grapple with when you're walking your way through the film and watching it come down, right?
Well, no, I will agree with Robert Reich. He says there is no such thing as corporate social responsibility. And that really means that corporations legally are bound to put shareholder value, profit, above everything else. And so, you know, what he says is not some fanciful statement. It's not an opinion. It's actually legal fact. But that doesn't preclude corporations doing some good in society, but it's complex. Like everybody used to before Bill Gates has been exposed as having some pretty dubious private practices and around sexual misconduct, you know, people always used to point to Bill Gates. Well, it's very complicated, Bill Gates. Like, why does one man have so much power to control public health? And people, you know, don't know, a lot of people don't know that two of Bill Gates's foundations were responsible for the formation of COVAX with the WHO. And Bill Gates's, those foundations actually blocked the WHO as having a leadership role in COVAX. And, you know, now the, you know, such a huge issue and such injustice regarding COVID vaccine apartheid, you know, the release of intellectual property related to the COVID vaccine is one of the biggest justice issues that we're facing on the planet today. And yet it's the the behind the scenes workings of Bill Gates's foundation that is in many ways preventing the release of those intellectual property rights. So all I'm really pointing to is, you know, the complexity of these issues. So yes, you know, arguably Bill Gates has contributed to worldwide vaccination, not only for COVID, but other diseases. But, you know, it's come at a great benefit to himself. And also currently, the fact that the bottleneck in terms of COVID vaccine supply is the release of intellectual property rights. You know, arguably, it's causing a great deal of unnecessary suffering and death. So, you know, all I'm really saying is, and I think all our film is saying, is absolutely, some corporations provide valuable goods and services, but it's much more complicated than that. And ultimately, decision-making needs to rest with government, democratically elected governments. And obviously, full democracy is always aspirational. It's never perfect, and there's absolutely corrupt governments working in the world today. But we can't lose the aspiration for democracy, because really it is the only tool that we have to have a society that is built on the desires of the people and citizens that live within it.
So is the position then that unless there is a strong a strong position from democracy to tighten the reins, because as you say in the film, the ability for corporations to self-regulate certainly hasn't happened in the last 10 years, let alone the last 40 years, therefore corporations are irredeemable. Isn't the only position, therefore, if corporations are beyond redemption, elimination completely?
No, I don't think so. I think that there are certain actions that can be taken that can make some corporations redeemable. Some are not redeemable. Let's face it. Like, one might argue that tobacco manufacturers, fossil fuel corporations that can, you know, especially one that has acted such as Exxon and really denied the climate catastrophe for so many decades. Like, these corporations likely are not redeemable. But regulation certainly can rein in the corporate harms and enhance corporate benefits. Corporations paying their fair taxes, that is another absolutely an important key policy decision, and I'm certainly heartened by the Biden administration's attempt to have a international and universal corporate tax rate to stop this extraordinary siphoning off of public money to tax havens by some of the biggest corporations. I mean, this would permit governments to have the kind of resources they need to create a society that I think all of us want. So those are two huge, huge policy areas that I think can shape the system and create much more of the world that so many of us crave. I mean, on the other hand, I do feel that we have been trapped inside a very myopic point of view, you know, neoliberalism, this sort of propagation of this, the idea of even who we are as a species, that ultimately we're just out for ourselves, we're competitive, we're selfish. Absolutely, we are those things, but we're so much more. And I think that everybody, not everybody, but many people crave meaning in their lives, that are and also sort of a community and to have their lives contribute to something larger than themselves. That's also a very important part of what it is to be human. So you know, there's many things that can shift and change, and we need to start to imagine something other than what is, because sadly what is has has really left us in extraordinarily dire circumstance. And as the film explores, you know, just choose your existential crises. There's just so many we face today. And to a large part, not entirely, but to a large part, we can really, I think, accurately point the blame in the direction of 21st century corporate capitalism as it has currently emerged.
You're listening to Saturday Morning on RNZ National. I'm Julia Wilcox, filling in for Kim Hill. We're talking to Jen Abbott, co-director of the new corporation, the unfortunately necessary sequel. Jen, you make a call for action at the last part of the film, which I guess is juxtaposed against the bleakness of the situation that led to Trump. And also actions that have happened post your first film in 2003. How delicate a balance was it to paint the picture of the current situation and then the call for action towards the end of the film?
I mean, I think that it was really important for Joel Bakken, the writer and co-director, and Peter Roick, the editor, and myself. We felt very, very strongly that, you know, This moment in time, you know, we are just right at the edge of the cliff, and there's so many reasons that we could go off it, and we really wanted to portray that vertiginous fate in all its despair, and that's a very difficult thing to do in a documentary, because there's a lot of pressure not to be too depressing, but we were very, very insistent that no, we call it Act Two. And we just go deep, deep, deep into this despair. But we didn't want to leave audiences there, and nor do we believe that the situation is hopeless. So absolutely, it was important that in addition to outlining the existential crises that we face today, we wanted to inspire viewers, and we wanted to show the strength and resilience of so many people and movements around the world. Now, that said, to be quite honest with you, until quite late in the post-production process, it just didn't feel like it was an appropriate balance for me. And the Act Three that we call it, you know, the stories of inspiration and change, just didn't have the same weight or depth. It didn't feel like it could match the corporate behemoth that we are facing until the Black Lives Matter uprising. And we actually broke picture lock for that as well. We broke it for COVID as well. And for me and my collaborators, you know, the extraordinary just the numbers, the effectiveness, the truth-telling, the challenge not only to racist structures of oppression, but also how these are reflected in public allocation of resources, say to the military and police, and not as much to healthcare and education, like the exposure of all these injustices and people taking to the streets as they did. When we were able to include that momentous occasion, that's when, for us, Act Three really did take shape and had the weight that we felt was necessary to have the authentic feeling that change was possible. And obviously, authenticity is key.
Yeah, I did wonder about that, Jen, because you do identify people like, you know, AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You talk about Bernie Sanders. You identify Sadiq Khan, also Ada Colau, at a time, obviously, before the 2020 American election. I did wonder whether or not that was intentional and it happened before the American election to potentially drive political activism before the US election or not.
Yes, we did. It was before the election. It was released before, and it actually was. Yes, we certainly did want to, as much as we could impact anyone's voting choices. That was intentional. Yes.
What do you say then now
I
then
mean,
for
really, Trump or not, I mean, Trump gone at least gives us a fighting chance. You know, 4 more years of Trump and we're off the cliff.
What about then in the global context when you've got people like UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, whose numbers are still quite high? You identify Scott Morrison, then a Treasurer of Australia, now the Prime Minister of Australia, still very popular despite what's happening with coronavirus. Erdogan, yes, he's lost support, but he still shades the opposition parties in Turkey at the moment. Viktor Orban, you also identify as well. His popularity has dropped, but he's still ahead. How effective, how do you measure the success then of this documentary, given the global context has still seen the retention of power and a lot of those strong male figures that you talk about in the film?
We obviously only can do what we can do. I think it would, you know, would take a lot of hubris on my part to think that all of a sudden all these strong men are going to fall because of our film. Though, of course, that would be the best case scenario. But I mean, I can say that really time will tell. I mean, it's not going to only be our film. Obviously, there's just this huge amount of extraordinary media and writing and art that's coming out that's challenging the system. But, you know, I will say that in regards to our first film, it got credited as being one of the top 10 films to inspire the Occupy movement. And so, you know, that was several years after its release, and one of the things that I'm most proud of with regards to that film. So, you know, you just never know the way that a film is going to impact society ultimately.
There was a big focus on JP Morgan, and in particular its CEO, Jamie Dimon. Why?
Well, because Jamie Dimon in many ways is one of the poster boys, I'll use that gender term intentionally, of the new corporation movement. And, you know, is sort of heralded as this great leader within, you know, the new corporation, for people who haven't seen it, is sort of the revamped corporation, which is now our friend and is acting on behalf of society. And so because he is such a high profile CEO and a poster boy, we really just wanted to delve into that a little bit and just show some of the hypocrisy of that point of view.
Why did Lord John Brown, the former CEO of BP, agree to come on?
Well, this is a great question, and you'd have to ask him that. I think certainly with our first film, you know, we had many more corporate insiders agree to interviews with us. It helped that we had Milton Friedman agree to an interview early on in that process. Yeah, I mean, I don't really know why. He had full disclosure, you know, we never misrepresent ourselves. That's not part of our ethics. We're completely upfront about who we are and the kind of film we're making.
He must have known.
Have to ask him.
He must have known, though, the negative portrayal that was going to be made of him, particularly leading up to, you know, obviously what happened with BP, even before he left BP, you know, Texas oil spill where 15 people died in 2005, 180 people injured, the Alaskan oil spill as well. And this is all before he left, before Deepwater Horizon. I mean, he must, you used the word hubris before. I wonder if that's a part of why he agreed.
You know what, I can't second guess his motivation. Sometimes any publicity is considered good publicity. I don't know. I really don't know. And not only that, Joel's first book, he also allocated quite a bit of time to BP. So he would have had access to that as well. I don't know.
Interesting. The film also focuses on Indigenous protest and activism within Indigenous communities around the world, but you particularly focus on Great Barrier. I hope I get this right, with the Wangan and Jagalagnu people in Great Barrier. You talked to Marara Johnson. You also talked to Grand Chief Philip Stewart of British Columbia and Canada. Why a lot of time dedicated to those Indigenous communities and those Indigenous movements across the world?
Well, I think several reasons, really. So, and it's the Wangan and Jagalingu, who are just, you know, really, that's okay. I had to be taught. and I probably got it wrong there too. But anyway, I think it's really important for us to profile disenfranchised and marginalized voices. That is one issue. And then another is that Indigenous people are frequently on the front lines of these fights against extractive resources and extractive corporations. And not only that, they're the ones frequently that bear so much of the suffering related to destructive corporate harms, whether or not, as in the Wangan and Jagalingu, you know, their country is being overrun by open pit coal mining, and which will destroy the Great Artesian Water Basin, in addition to a huge amount of their country, and is so close as well to the already dying Great Barrier Reef. So, you know, it's really just very important to recognize and acknowledge and give credit to these climate frontliners and Indigenous frontline activists whose voices have so often been marginalized and not heard.
I have to ask this because, as you know, there's still talk in America of Donald Trump potentially standing again for the Republican Party for the presidential elections in 2024. If he is re-elected, can we expect installment three?
Well, I don't think he's going to be. That's the good news. I will remain non-committal about installment three.
They were saying this before 2016, remember, Jen? There's no way he will get elected, and yet we ended up where we ended up.
Well, and things have changed significantly. I do really see a fraction, like this is, the Republican Party is just so divided right now, as are Republicans themselves, between those that are either believing or pretending to believe the big lie and those that aren't. So anyway, it's very, I'm leaning more towards going into fiction film writing. And I tell you, you couldn't make this stuff up. This is like really extraordinary narrative. It's too bad that it's also just so dangerous for the world.
Jen, I want to thank you very much for your time. Congratulations on the documentary, The New Corporation, the unfortunately necessary sequel. We wish you all the best for it. What are you hoping New Zealand audiences will say? Will the reaction that they will have to the film when they see it?
Oh, I hope that New Zealanders will invite me to become an honorary New Zealand citizen, because I love your country and I love your prime minister. And I have often this last year wished I was there. I've been there before, and it's such a beautiful country with beautiful people. So yes, please invite me to be, that's a very self-interested response, an honest one. And also, I do want to just also mention that my other film, The Magnitude of All Things, which is about ecological grief, is also at the same festival, Dock Edge. I'd love it if people checked that out as well.
We wish you all the best for both the New Corporation and The Magnitude of All Things. Jen, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. It was a really pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Yeah, that was, of course, Jen Abbott, co-director of The New Corporation, the unfortunately necessary sequel, which is screening in theatres in Wellington and Auckland this month as a part of Dock Edge Festival. It will also be screening online nationwide from late June this year. You can visit the Dock Edge website for more details on dockedge.nz.